Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang. This time around, we'll review Crossroads at Dark Lion Pass from Strategy Rich Games, Alien Frontiers from Clever Mojo, Washington's War from GMT, and Zulus on the Ramparts from Victory Point Games. We'll also talk about the game we most want for the holidays and a whole lot more gaming goodness on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, coming to you from my hospital bed, it's Jeff McAleer.
And Elliot Miller in my basement.
I thought it's the Villa Park Studios, wasn't that
Villa
it?
Park Studios.
That's right. No, I'm not really in my hospital bed, but I am battling viral pneumonia. That's pretty fun. I thought it was just a flu bug that I couldn't shake for about 3 weeks. And being a man, we don't go to the doctor unless we think we're dying. So, well, isn't that true?
Yes, I can't have my manliness questioned by attending the doctor's office.
That's right.
Many times he will look at me and say, oh my God, you're such a wuss. Get out of my office.
Do I have to remove another splinter, Mr. Miller? Don't you think we have better things to do here in this doctor's office?
Do I still get a lollipop?
You just go for the enemas. You know it. So, welcome back. Thanks for coming by and joining us. We will actually talk about games now. Or something gaming related.
Yeah.
Maybe. If we get around to it.
That's our plan. All kinds of gaming goodness.
There you go.
Oh, hey, before we start talking about games, I just wanted to mention, and well, it's kind of gaming related. I want to say thank you to the 46 people who have visited my other website, www.voiceofe.com.
What is that?
That is my voiceover work website. And I recently, you know, where I do voiceovers. That's why I do the intro and the outro and stuff like that.
Well, you talk over me all the time. I mean, you have to have a website for that?
Right. Well, sometimes I need to get my own word in edgewise. So I have my own website so I can do that.
It's just recordings of you talking to yourself.
Right. I take my half of the Skype recording and post it there so people can just hear me laughing randomly at various odd points in the show.
And then just you saying, mm-hmm, right?
Uh-huh, right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yes. No, and you were able to score 46 people to come and listen to that?
No, I made an appearance on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, hppodcraft.com. And found those guys because I'm a big H.P. Lovecraft fan, you know, and with our Call of Cthulhu RPG background and Arkham Horror and all that, I listen to it a lot, and it's really a good podcast. It's funny. It's really informative. I asked if I could do a read for them. And they said, yeah, sure. So I got to make an appearance on the last episode. And a lot of people came and checked out my website, all 46 of them. So thanks, everybody. I'm used to having like one hit.
Very cool. Very cool. Although I have to point out that I did check out, I'm kidding. Of course, I heard the podcast because you told me about it. Although I don't believe it's actually you who's on the show.
What?
Well, according to their website, it's Elliot Miller, but it's Elliot with one T.
Oh, that guy again.
The other guy.
He's always one step ahead of me.
Well, because he's lighter on his feet. He only has to lug around one T.
That's right. He saves a whole lot of time with that one T. E-L-L-I-O-T-T.
Here he goes again. Why don't we just make that the theme song?
That's what I'm thinking.
I did want to mention a little bit of gaming news. Our friends over at Out of the Box Publishing sent along what I consider to be a really fantastic way for everybody out there to easily help get into the spirit of giving for the holiday season without really having to invest a whole lot of time and energy. What's going on right now is Out of the Box is donating one new game to Toys for Tots for every 10 new Facebook fans. So I'll give you an example. In March of 2010, Out of the Box launched a campaign to donate 80 games to needy families through Toys for Tots. What they've done here is if you just go to facebook.com/outoftheboxgames, all you have to do is click the like button. And for every 10 people who do that, they're going to give away a free game to Toys for Tots, as I'd like to see them get about 1 million hits.
Right, and put them out of business.
Would that be funny, though? Well, we gave away 100,000 games.
I'm sure they would find some way to cover, you know, it would all be a big tax deduction anyway. But well, of course, you're right. It's really a great thing for them to do.
I thought it was very, very cool.
They were so cool to me when I saw them at Chi-Tag when I talked with Leah Sugar. Mm-hmm. And they were very nice and they demonstrated their games and she was very helpful. And it seems like a really nice company.
Well, we have a video of your visit on the website.
Yeah, yeah.
Myself, personally, I have not met Leah, but I have emailed back and forth. And yeah, she definitely seems like a very classy young lady out of the box overall. I mean, we have nothing but great things to say about them.
Yeah, they're very cool.
Plus, come on, Ninja versus Ninja is a fun little game.
Actually, I haven't played Ninja versus Ninja, but I have played Pirate versus Pirate, which adds a whole nother dimension to Ninja versus Ninja because it's got... It's triangular rather
it's
than...
Got triangles it's got triangles rather than squares. Rather than
squares. And so...
You can move in three different directions rather than four.
It really added to the gameplay because rather than just running across the board, you have to calculate your moves, you know?
Mm-hmm. And that's what you do in Ninja versus Ninja.
Right, but it's harder to plan for a move when you're moving... triangularly. Trust me.
Is that a word?
I believe I just made that word up.
You better copyright it.
Copyright 2010, Elliot Miller Productions.
What is that what we are now? We're Elliot Miller Productions?
Hey, this is my copyright. It's my word.
It's all about you. I also understand that you can take the ninjas from Ninja versus Ninja and put them in Pirate versus Pirate.
Yeah, and those little things are so cool. I mean, they're like little toys, you know? My daughter had a blast playing with them. And
your four-year-old.
Exactly. Even playing the game. I mean, nobody ever got to the point where they actually won by collecting the coins. Mm-hmm. Every game always ended with taking out the other players.
That's the kind of guy you are.
But it was a lot of fun. Mini review.
Very cool.
Of
hey,
Pirate
I was
going to
say,
Pirate.
So there's a little review talking about our gaming news for Out of the Box.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of reviews, I believe we should move on to that.
All right. And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game reviews. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
The first game I was going to talk about is Crossroads at Dark Lion Pass from Strategy Rich Games. Now, right. This is their first game that they've published. You know, it wasn't a bad game. I can see it appealing to certain people and not appealing to certain other people. It's also got a lot of different mechanics tossed in.
Yeah, it's a board game, role-playing game hybrid.
Right, that's exactly true. You know, I haven't decided yet whether that's a good thing or not a good thing. The price point is fairly good with the game, and, you know, it's reflected in their components.
Well, what is the price point?
It's $35.99.
$35.99?
Right. The game itself was designed by Steve Schroeder at Strategy Rich Games. It just came out this year. It's for 2 to 6 players. The age range is 14 plus, but, you know, I think they could go down some. Takes about 120 minutes to play, which is 2 hours for those of you who aren't aware.
I was breaking out my calculator on that.
Really, after the first game, you can get it a lot lower than 2 hours. It does start to move quickly once you know what you're doing. The game comes with a bunch of play cards, you know, you use in your hands. It comes with deck of treasure cards. It's got the generic tokens.
Let's be honest, they're poker chips.
Yeah, they're not even...
They're poker chips that you would go and get at, like, a dollar store.
Right. Kind of like something you would use, say, in bingo. It comes with a skill pad. You use one for each player each game. It's a full-color pad, you know, so, and this is where the Roll Through the Ages aspect comes in. Track of your experience, you gain skill levels, similar to the way, you know, you gain bonuses in Roll Through the Ages. Experience points, you spend those experience points to get skill levels, and at the end of the game, the winner is the one who has the most skill levels accumulated. That's their points.
Right.
It also comes with a travel pawn. Initially, each player selects one of their player tokens.
Doesn't it have a map?
No, there's no map. It also comes with a game board. For me, I wasn't that impressed with the game board itself. It was reminiscent to me of like a children's game, like Candyland.
I hate the game board. You and I have discussed this. It is just god-awful.
Yeah, and I'm not big on the game board itself. Well, let me get into it. There's two parts to the game. There's the travel phase of the game, and there's the quest phase of the game. Now, during the travel phase is when you use this board to move your entire group, and it's your whole group is just represented by one pawn, across these little mm-hmm. colored circles. And each of you start with 5 cards, and you get to draw 2 cards each turn. And you play cards. The cards are very multi-purpose. They cover healing, they cover attacks, they cover movement. And you use them for bidding. Well, the travel leader, there's a travel leader card, and each player gets to be the travel leader at one point, and the card gets passed from player to player on each consecutive turn. So you become the travel leader, you decide where you're going to move this little pawn. And you can move it by playing a card that's got a little footprint on it. It either has one footprint or two footprints, saying you can move one or two squares. If you pass over a certain color on the game board, you earn 100 experience points.
For that player who owns that color.
So even if you pass over somebody else's color, that person gets the 100 experience points. And you immediately spend that to gain a skill level. After the leader moves the pawn, every other player gets a chance to play a card and move the pawn if they want control. There's several paths you can go along to the next quest. The game definitely leads from quest to quest to quest to quest to quest. And there's 6 quests in all that you're going to face throughout the whole game. So once you go through the entire movement phase...
So let's wrap this up, because this game blows, dude. If I were listening to this review, I'd be moving on to another show. Because the game sucks. And I know you like this game more than I did by a great stretch. With this game, myself personally, there's just way too much record-keeping going on for what this game is. Counting up your experience points, pass over a color on the map that corresponds to that player's color. They get 100 experience points. You get more experience points by walking down the road than you do by fighting monsters.
Sometimes that is true.
I think the components are pretty nice, except for that that map. I just can't get away from that map. I can't spend 90 minutes looking at that map. It makes my eyes hurt.
It's very bright.
It's just horrible.
I didn't really have a problem with the record keeping, you know, because, I'm used to having to do that kind of stuff. Oh, I mean, so are you. But I'm not used to doing it in, like, a board game. It took a while. Once you earn so many skill levels, you have to figure out, okay, I'm getting these bonuses from these skill levels. And then I played these cards, which have these bonuses. And then, oh, but it's affected by this monster only has this against this particular weapon type, like edged weapons. So it got actually a little slower near the end because you had to spend a minute figuring out exactly how much damage you did. And I think it had too many options tossed into the second half of the game. Because the travel part, yeah, it is goofy to think that you're getting experience just for moving across the board. But I understand why the mechanic is there. But in the second parts, it's way more complex because they have all of these different cards and they have different... I still don't know. They have this thing called life drain, and I still don't know what that does. I mean, we initially assumed that it meant you drain life so you get life back from the monster, but I found out it doesn't mean that at all.
It's actually your own life that's being drained while playing the game.
Heard that. I don't know.
No, I'm talking about you personally playing the game. It's your life force.
Like I said, in my opinion, it wasn't a bad game. It wasn't a great game. It definitely had some problems. I think there were too many mechanics mixed in because there's an auction game, it's a hand management game, it's a questing and damage game, it's got all kinds of different things in it, and maybe there's just a little too much to make it a great game. You know, it would appeal to some people.
To me, there's too much there to make it a good game. It's cooperative, but it's not cooperative. It's a board game role-playing game that doesn't have enough role-playing to appeal to role players, and it's got too much role-playing involved for board gamers. So I'm not sure who this game is
for. I do think that, you know, they did try to throw in as much as they possibly can, and it's a little over the top.
Well, my copy did come with a kitchen sink, just so you know.
That is Crossroads of Dark Lion Pass from Strategy Rich Games.
Should we move on to a game that we both can agree we enjoyed? And that would be Alien Frontiers.
Yes, I did enjoy Alien Frontiers. Mm-hmm. Alien Frontiers is from Clever Mojo Games. Alien Frontiers is a game that's been getting a lot of press lately. It was released by Clever Mojo Games just this year, just a few months ago, and it's designed by Tori Neiman. 2 to 4 players, ages 13 and up, retails for $50. Playing time is 90 minutes, a little less once you get to know the game a little bit better. One of the really nice things about this game is the components. One of the first games, as you know, that was funded through Kickstarter.
Right.
As far as it got press related to it anyway. My first exposure to Kickstarter anyway.
Right.
And they were able to get a lot of funding, and so they were able to provide a lot of quality components. There's 25 dice, all of them different colors. Well, 6 of each color plus 1 bonus relic ship.
Right. No, there's 25 different colors of dice. It's amazing. It's incredible. I especially enjoyed my fuchsia die.
I preferred the magenta one, really. There's alien tech cards that all have this nice artwork on them. The game board is covered with a bunch of nice artwork and is very well done. The artwork's by Mark Maxwell, and the graphic design was by Kareem Chukran. There's a victory point scoreboard, territory counters, field generator counters, colony tokens, which are little like half moon shapes. And the whole object of the game is to be the one with the most victory points. When the first player who places his last colony on the planet, that triggers the end of the game. And whoever has the most victory points at that point wins the game.
Right. You're trying to colonize this planet that's been found that also has alien technology.
You know, it maybe would have been a little better if it went the whole alien route and you found, you know, people start getting eaten by, well, okay. That's beside the point.
Yeah, maybe if you designed it.
The planet's broken up into different territories and you place colonies on the territories themselves and you gain control of that territory if you have the most colonies in that particular section. And that's one of the unique things in this game is the dice represent your ships. Each turn, right, you get to roll your dice and then you place them. There's different actions. It's a worker placement game. The only difference is the worker placement is you placing your dice in various areas around the board.
It's a dicing for resources kind of game. Because one thing you have to keep in mind, too, is you have to have certain scores for certain areas that you want to put your dice. Little bit different than a worker placement game in that respect, because normally in a worker placement game, you can place your worker wherever that's available. Whereas with this, there's a little bit of a different twist because some of the areas do require a specific die roll or higher.
Yes. And
to be able to put your dice.
For example, you have to roll three of a kind on your dice to be able to put your dice in a certain spot. Or you have to roll a straight with three dice to be able to put them in another spot. So the dice roll really does matter in what you can do on the game board.
Most people would probably equate that. It's not exactly the same. It is similar to Kingsburg.
Right. I've seen a lot of comparisons.
Is a good example. Right. Depending on what your die roll is what you can do and where you would be able to place those dice. With Alien Frontiers, as opposed to Kingsburg, you have a lot more dice that you're rolling. And you have more combinations. Normally in Kingsburg, you can break up your roll. I'm going to put two dice here, one die here. Whereas you're rolling more of a handful of dice, which is going to appeal to a lot of people out there who enjoy rolling
definitely.
Dice.
I mean, you start the game with three ships, which is three dice. But you can build more ships and you get more dice. So that gives you more options as the game goes on. And, you know, God forbid you hang back and don't build enough ships and everybody else is rolling six dice and you're sitting there with three.
You might as well go watch football then.
I should point out, I do have a much more detailed review online where I go into it a lot deeper. I'm not going to talk about it for 20 minutes here on the podcast. Few of the difficulties I saw with the game is, well, for one, you can have a turn where there's nothing you can do. The spots are filled. You didn't roll anything good and there's no place you can go. Yeah.
Kind of like it.
They have this thing, this, you know, generic space called the maintenance bay where you can put your dice, just nothing happens. You just put them there. Yeah. And it's almost
like Loserville.
And that did happen several times to people who were playing the game. It's especially during your first turn, your first round of turns. The fourth player is at a definite disadvantage because the first player gets to place his stuff and then the second, the third, the fourth player has to just go with whatever's left. And if they don't roll a good enough roll, they're stuck just tossing stuff in the maintenance bay. They do try to address it by giving bonus resources to every player after, but, you know, it still doesn't cover
the first,
everything.
Right.
I would have liked to have seen, like, if you're in the maintenance bay, you have an option. So it was my thought that if the maintenance bay could be used as like, okay, you place your dice there, and then sometime during the other player's turns, you can swap out one of your dice for one of their dice that they've that's been placed on the board. So thereby, you know, either denying them one ship or just changing the role of one of their dice. You know, you replace their six with your one. And now suddenly, instead of three sixes that they can use to do this action, they're stuck with two sixes. So that was just one thought that I had for making the game a little more interactive and giving you something to do if you're stuck just going to the maintenance bay. After you get through the first round, since the dice all stay on the board, everybody's pretty much in the same boat, you know, because the dice stay there until your next turn, which is also something I like because it
right.
limits what you're going to be able to do, and you really have to plan around what is sitting there. I didn't really have a problem after the first game that we played with, you know, too much downtime between turns, because once you learn everything, you get over your analysis paralysis. Initially, when you play it, you're thinking, okay, what can I do? When really, if you really think about it, there's only like two actions on the board that you can legally do this turn, so you just got to decide between them.
If you say so. For myself, what I think impressed me the most about the game, and there are some minor issues with the design itself, no huge deal breakers or anything like that, but the first thing that jumped out to me was that it's not as if Alien Frontiers does anything truly new. There's no truly new mechanic that's involved in the game. The way that it's able to incorporate all these various different mechanics into an extremely polished product, I was astounded, to be very honest with you, because you and I see a lot of first-time games out there. We just finished talking about one. It's apples and oranges. I mean, they're completely different games. But from one company that did, let's be honest, have some other releases out there, more kind of like family, smaller games, and comparing it to a lot of the other first-time games that come across our desks,
yeah,
it's amazing. It really is amazing, from the artwork to the way the rules are laid out. And I know, you know, maybe I'm not the brightest bulb on the string, but for myself, the rules weren't that easy to catch on to.
A couple of times to catch on to the whole mechanics of the game.
Right. Maybe I'm kind of a dope, you know, playing through it. It did take a little bit of time to kind of get the hang of it. And I know, you know, I see other, you know, reviews and things out there where people are like, wow, you know, super easy to pick up the game and you can teach it in 5 minutes.
No,
not really.
Well, our first game.
At least not me. Right. The first game we played probably ran almost that long, maybe 2.5 hours. And that's something else that I do want to mention as well. And it's not a criticism of the game whatsoever. And I think people need to be aware of this as well, is there is so much positive talk about Alien Frontiers right now, and rightfully so. But I think you're going to find people who are more party game kind of gamers. You know what I mean? Very, very light games. And this is a gateway game, in my opinion. But you'll find, and this is something I did want to mention, the first time I played this, I played with some people who came out to my bi-weekly gaming meetup, you know? And it was a bomb. The thing is, these were the people who I was playing it with who weren't, you know, the usual group that comes who are like into Power Grid or the new Civ and things like that. They were already actually playing a game of Power Grid. And they were like, wow, oh, hey, that's Alien Frontiers, all sweet. But they were already in the middle of the game. So I was playing with a lot of people who their gaming experiences are things like Wits and Wagers. People have to be aware that this is not going to be the kind of game that you're going to bust out to play Christmas Eve at, you know, Uncle Bob's house. And I know a lot of people are really chomping at the bit because right now you can't get the game. We were lucky enough that did receive review copies. It won't be available again until March. A much bigger print run this time. I believe the original one was about 500 copies. I've been informed by Clever Mojo that this print run will be 3,000 copies. So you'll have a better chance of getting it. But there's so much positive talk out there. When it does become available again is when you'll be able to buy it. They are doing pre-orders once again, so you can get your hands on it.
Yeah. Don't sit on your hands overhyped this time. You know, where other gamers say, wow, everybody loves this game, I have to get this game. And then they get it, and, you know, it's just not the game for them.
It might be the game for them, but they have to be aware of the kind of games that they normally play with their friends. So you want to make sure, because there's nothing worse, in my opinion, than getting a game that everybody's been raving about. And you're like, man, I got to get, oh, sweet, I got it. And you get home and you're opening it up and you're, oh, look at this. Oh. And then you get people together and you're going to play it. And it's just not their kind of game, because a lot of times your impression of a game is going to be based
on without a doubt.
The people you play it with, too. So if they're not having a good time, you're sure not going to have a good time either. So it was just something I did want to mention.
Yeah, big thumbs up for Alien Frontiers.
But big thumbs up.
Really had a good time playing that game.
And as you already did mention, feel free to stop at thegaminggang.com and you can read Elliot's more in-depth review as well.
Heed the call and take command in the war room. This edition of The War Room is sponsored by Victory Point Games. While all games are made with passion, Victory Point Games are a little special. That's because VPG is part game company and part classroom. At VPG, game industry veterans work together with others who are interested in learning all about the game business. These students, young and old, college age and veteran hobbyists, have joined together to study the game industry's many design, development, art, manufacturing, marketing, sales, and related business aspects. Stop by Victory Point Games and share their passion for great games. For a limited time, you can order the Dual Star Pack, two great sci-fi family games for one low price. When your homeworld is nearing its demise, it's time to saddle up your rocket ship and explore the neighborhood in nearby space. Parsec is a tile placement game of discovery and exploration in outer space for 2 to 4 players. Then, boldly go where no one has gone before in Final Frontier, where you command a vaunted starship crew of humans, aliens, and robots venturing onto new worlds and charting the unexplored quadrants of deep space to face fantastic challenges in the best storytelling traditions of episodic space operas. You can pick up the Dual Star Pack at victorypointgames.com.
So, hey, there you go. My first little segue piece, a little advertisement, huh? Huh? Not bad, huh? Huh, Mr. VoiceOver guy?
Yeah. Not bad, not bad. For an amateur, but that's fine.
Well, you know, I was thinking that I might create a new website, and I was going to call it The Voice of Jay.
See, I don't know, because that would make me think of Men in Black.
I'm right. Agent Jay.
Well, yeah, if I call it Agent Jay, maybe. So we're going to keep on rolling on with some more reviews. I've got two. One I'm going to talk about a little bit because I think I went into some pretty extended detail on the review on the website for the first game. And then I'm going to talk about a game from our sponsor of this segment, Victory Point Games. So first off, which is kind of funny, we're going to talk about a GMT game on a segment being sponsored by Victory Point Games, but I'm sure they'll be cool with it. Washington's War. This is one of the latest releases from GMT. It is another one of their excellent card-driven war games. And I think that we do kind of give a little short shift to war games on the website and podcast, especially the podcast.
And yeah, you know, and it's funny because we had such a background playing war games in our younger years, and we really haven't talked about them that much. So I like the fact that we're getting back into them more.
Right. We're not going to be, you know, a war game podcast or war game website because, of course, there's plenty of good ones out there. There's a lot of carryover. Of course, there are some people out there who are, you know, diehard grognards and that's all they're going to play. And there's other people who are just diehard Euro game style players and they'll never touch a war game. But there is, for most people, there is a lot of crossover. Washington's War is designed by Mark Herman. It's a reimagining of his original release, which, if memory serves me correct, this was the first card-driven game, war game, of course, We the People. So in many ways, it's very similar. In other ways, it's very, very different. I don't recall if I played We the People. I know I never owned it. I know you didn't own it. And then playing Washington's War, it didn't really ring any bells. I know I played 1776 from Avalon Hill. I had that, but I don't think I ever played We the People.
But yeah, I don't recall it either.
One respect, I think that's probably a good thing because I could come to playing the game with a completely open mind. I wasn't going to be able to compare it to, you know, how it stacked up with We the People because I'd never, or at least didn't remember playing it. So Washington's War really is an excellent introductory war game. It's for 2 players, ages 12 and up, and the playing time should be right about 90 minutes. On a very cool side note, the Golden Geek Awards just came out from Board Game Geek, and Washington's War, only game that actually won 2 Golden Geek Awards.
Really?
Yes.
Very nice.
the best two-player game, and best war game. I'm not going to devote a lot of time to talking about Washington's War, but as I mentioned, it is a card-driven game. One side is the Americans, the other side is the British. Thing I really like about the game, number one, the playtime is 90 minutes. And granted, the first time you play through, you're probably going to clock in a little over 2 hours, but I can easily see that being some truth in advertising, that 90-minute mark, which with a lot of games never is the case. They say, oh, you can play it in X amount of time, and you never get a game in that quickly. I think you can pull it off with Washington's War once you have the rules down. It's not overly complex. It's very deep. As with all card-driven war games, at least in my experience, there's a lot of tension. There is a lot of uncertainty going on that you won't find in a regular standard I move, you move kind of game because of the cards. You never know what's in somebody else's hand. You never know what's coming down the pike. I know from our game that we played of Twilight Struggle, which, of course, a lot of people will make comparisons of Washington's War to Twilight Struggle. You had an idea what you were going to do, just never knew if, you know, your opponent was going to whip out something and completely blow your plans to shreds.
Yes, exactly.
And that's one of the things I really enjoy about the game. Another thing I really want to point out too is, unlike many games that are based upon like a historical conflict or a historical event, both players have an equal chance of winning. Each side, the Americans and the British, each have their own strengths. And in return, they also have some weaknesses involved too. And if you can play to your strength, you're really going to be in the driver's seat. It's a great game. Definitely recommend picking it up. Probably wouldn't rate it as high as Twilight Struggle because I do have a few very minor complaints with the game. One is because with card-driven games, normally your cards are all events and you use your cards to either play the event or to generate something like operation points, which allow you to do different things. For an example, in Washington's War, you can use your operation points to bring in reinforcements. You can move a general, or you can also vie for political control within the colonies. Less than half the deck are events. The rest are all strictly operation points. And that kind of creates a little bit of a disconnect. Plus, you'll have some turns where all you have in your hand is really operation point cards. It's sort of like, well, I know what I'm going to do here because all I can do is use operation points. Another drawback I thought was that there are many events that people, of course, are going to remember from their American history class. You know, I don't think you really need to explain the Declaration of Independence. I mean, I think everybody pretty much has a handle on that. I don't think you really have to go into too much detail about Benedict Arnold trying to sell out the Americans and hand over West Point to the British. I don't think you really have to get into too much detail. But there are a lot of events that are sort of like, and I mean, I've read multitude of books about the American Revolution. It's sort of like, I'm trying to remember exactly what was that? What is the Jane McCrae Indian Massacre? So I think the game would have been better served to have some flavor text on the cards, even if it was a sentence or two.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, even, you know, just a quote from the particular character involved in the event card or something like that. Some little pertinent thing.
Exactly. And I think one of the things is, as far as on the cards, the fonts are fairly large. They could have shrank the font down a little bit and probably squeezed in a sentence or two.
Yeah.
So overall, like I said, my quibbles with this are very, very minor. I have a couple more that if people want to go read the review, they can see that as well. But definitely a serious pickup, a definite buy, in my opinion, and not just for people who are really into war games.
You know, for me, it was a great reintroduction back into war games, like a slow introduction. I mean, and I had a blast playing this with my son, the more strategic son.
Right, Brian.
Right.
Yeah, your oldest son.
College.
Right.
Yeah. And we had a blast playing this game. I'm looking forward to playing other games, but I think this was a really nice jump back into the whole war game genre.
And I think it might be easier for some people to kind of get into as far as comparing it to Twilight Struggle, which I think Twilight Struggle is a better game. I think it's fairly easy for somebody to say, well, yeah, I'll play the British Whereas with Twilight Struggle, I'm sure there are some people out there going, I don't want to play the commies.
Right.
Since you played it with Brian, I have to ask, who won?
Brian beat me. The kid always beats me. Maybe my brain is just getting old, befuddled. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, it should befuddled. I think that might be it. One last thing about Washington's War that I think is a big selling point, too, is regardless of what side you play, when you're done playing, you kind of want to go again and say, hey, let me play the British or let me play the Americans this time. Mm-hmm. You really want to kind of get a feel for it from the other side as well.
Right.
Great game. The other game that I'm going to talk about, because this is probably a game that a lot of people aren't real familiar with, coming from a company that unfortunately, once again, probably a lot of people aren't familiar with either, Victory Point Games, is Zulus on the Ramparts. This game came out last year, so it's from 2009. It's a solo game. It's designed by Alan Emmerich and Joseph Miranda. You're playing the British during the Battle of Rorke's Drift, which took place, this was back in 1879 with the British Zulu War. If anybody's ever seen the movie Zulu, they know exactly what's going on. What happened was there was a mission station. Just earlier that morning, an entire British column had been practically wiped out at Isandlwana. What happened was following that battle, there was a corps of Zulus who hadn't actually taken part in that battle. So they were spoiling for a fight. There were about 4,000 of them. And they went off to Rorke's Drift, which was garrisoned by about 140 British soldiers and their auxiliaries. And they attacked the mission station. The British were able to hold out for nearly 12 hours against unbelievable odds. The Battle of Rorke's Drift is probably one of the most famous balls-to-the-wall defenses. Battle saw more Victoria Crosses awarded than any before or since. So out of the about 140 British troops, if I remember correctly, there was about 12 Victoria Crosses awarded. Pretty impressive.
How did it actually end? Forgive my ignorance.
Well, let me tell you. As far as with the game itself, like I said, it's a solitaire game. I'll be very upfront. This is probably one of the best solitaire war games I have ever played. B-17, Queen of the Skies, by all means, another awesome solitaire game. Mm-hmm. But Zulus on the Ramparts, playing the British, defending Rorke's Drift. You have your game board. The rules booklet is about 6 pages long, and you've got some various counters. The interesting thing, too, is the British aren't really represented by counters. They're represented by cards. So you do have event cards. So this is another card-driven war game, but this time it's a solo game. And it's part of Victory Point Games' States of Siege line of games. The first one was Israeli Independence. Your game map is kind of a layout of Rorke's Drift. The British holding off the Zulus, and they're approaching the mission station from 4 different directions. Of course, you know, you're looking to try to prevent the Zulus from arriving to the center of the map. Each path has a Zulu MP, which is like a battalion, which is attacking. And you never know where they're coming from. The station is the center point. Each of the paths that lead into the center have 5 spaces in which the Zulus will move. And you get a limited number of actions in which to defend this tiny patch of ground. My understanding from my history is that the entire battlefield, you know, where all this was taking place, was about half the size of a baseball diamond, including the outfield, I would assume. I mean, come on.
Right.
You're playing these cards, but the movement of the Zulus isn't determined by cards. It's determined by these little round markers that you'll put like in a coffee cup or something, and you'll draw them out at random. Every turn you draw an impi marker and you move the Zulus, and then you take one action, or if you have some heroes on the board, some extra actions and draw a card. You can also place a hero onto the table. You're trying to hold out until the relief column shows up. And you have 36 event cards, and the relief column card is shuffled into like the last 4 cards of the deck.
Mm-hmm.
So you know you're going to be, you know, spending most of the game trying to keep these Zulus at bay. Also, right about the halfway point, it turns to night, and it makes it a little more difficult for the British at night because historically, about half the battle did take place at night. So the only forces that are actually represented on the map are the four Zulu battalions, and they each have a different number of hits, and they randomly approach on these four different paths. So when you draw this little chit out of a cup, it might say that you're moving the Zulus on the left two spots, or maybe you're moving the left and the right one spot. They can move one, two, or three spaces closer. And it could be on all four fronts. So other chits actually provide events like Henry rifles heating up, buildings catching on fire, Zulus regrouping. Because when you fire at the Zulus, you don't necessarily knock off these little hit points, because each of the MPs start off with four hits. Mm-hmm. You can push them back, or you can actually take away some of the hits. One thing I really enjoy about the game is it's going to be different every time you play.
Yeah.
I'll be very upfront. First time I played, I got smoked. I did. I got smoked. I mean, it would have been like nobody's writing anything in any history books about this one.
Right. The Mission Massacre.
Right. It would be a footnote. Now, I'm going to actually write a much more in-depth review on the website itself in the next couple of days or so. As far as a solo game, and you really should be somewhat of a war gamer to purchase it. You don't have to be a huge grognard. You can't be one of these, you know, peace, love. I can't play a game that has any kind of conflict or anything like that to really enjoy it. Now, this comes from a small company. And Victory Point Games, the way they present their games is they're kind of like boutique games. I will be actually interviewing Alan Emmerich in the near future, because I do find Victory Point Games to be very interesting, just like I find GMT to be very interesting, just outside of their just doing games.
Uh-huh.
If you're expecting the components to be something that you would get from Fantasy Flight, you are going to be sorely disappointed. And I know you yourself, you're a big component fan. I mean, that's one of the first things. I think everybody's kind of the same way. The first thing they look at is, oh, wow, these components are really sweet.
Yeah.
A la Alien Frontiers.
Right.
Here, they're good. They're not great. But then again, you're also looking at about a $20 price point.
Yeah.
Big difference there. And once again, it is kind of a small boutique kind of company. Excellent game. Loads of replayability. Now, the second time I played, I did win. I was able to hang out and hold out until the relief column showed up. As I had mentioned, it's kind of funny. In Washington's War, the event cards have absolutely no flavor text.
Mm-hmm.
In Zulus on the Ramparts, they do. So each card, even if it's just a standard kind of like volley card, some are fairly generic. They repeat. It's kind of like it's a volley card. You know, it's the same as like another one or two cards that are in the deck. But everyone has unique flavor text talking about either the battle or either famous quotes from those who were involved on the British side or quotes from the movie Zulu.
Huh.
Yeah, so I thought that was very cool that's included as well. Yeah, you did ask how did this historically play out.
Mm-hmm.
The British were able to hold out 140 against 4,000.
Oh my God.
They did take losses, but I think if memory serves me correctly, I think it was overall, you know, even from wounds, you know, later on down the, you know, a few days later, I think they lost maybe 20 soldiers. Interesting tidbit, just to tell you how hard the fighting was. The mission station was also like a depot for ammunition. So the British started with 20,000 rounds of ammunition.
Uh-huh.
When the fight was over, they had 900 rounds left.
Wow.
I know the subject matter, some people might be like, well, you know, it's a little politically incorrect. It's history. What can I tell you? Plus, you also have to keep in mind, too, if you think about it, those Zulu warriors, and they were crack troops. Now, granted, they had rifles and that, too, but not the kind of firepower that the British had. Mm-hmm. You had to be a pretty courageous individual to be storming the British troops firing at you, and all you had was a shield and a spear.
Yeah.
There was heroism on both sides. Excellent game. Definitely recommend picking it up. You can go to victorypointgames.com and order that and take a look at some of the other games that they do have in that same States of Siege series. They've got the Israeli Independence, and I know they have Soviet Dawn. I believe there might be one more that's not popping into my head. For the first edition of the War Room, both games, excellent buys.
Excellent. Our kids are the gamers of the future. Why don't we put away the Xbox and take a look at a board game made just for them? Since this is the first review of a children's game on the Gaming Gang podcast, I thought I'd talk about the first game that I had my daughter play. Now, she's turning 4 today, and I have to admit that the first game that I had her play was Candyland. Yes, I know. Turned out that that was a very poor choice. At the time, she was 2, and she just really couldn't get into it. The game lasted too long. She didn't care about moving the pieces to the next color. She just liked taking the pieces and moving them here, moving them here, moving them here. And, you know, when we got to the point where you had to try to explain that, oh no, you have to move back to here, and now Daddy's in the lead. Well, that didn't go over very well at all. So, instead, I'd like to go to the first game that I should have gotten my daughter, which she has played now, and we have a blast playing, although she's a little beyond the age for it now. She's advanced a wee bit. And that game is Go Away Monster. It's by Game Right. This game is for 1 to 4 players, and the recommended ages are 3 and up, but I really think the probable age is between the ages of 2 and 4. This game consists of 4 boards, 1 for each player, and they're set up like a bedroom. And then there's a whole bunch of pieces that come with the game. Now there's a bed, a lamp, an oval frame where a picture goes, and a teddy bear. The goal is to get all the pieces that go into your bedroom. These are nice cardboard pieces, they're very thick, and the boards are of great quality too. The artwork is cutesy, appropriate for 2 to 4 year olds. And you get this cloth bag, and along with these cardboard pieces, there are 8 monsters, and all of these pieces go into the bag. So when it's your turn, you reach into the bag and pull out a piece. If it's a monster, you yell, "Go away, monster!" and discard that piece to the side. If it's a piece that you need in your bedroom, then you take that piece and put it in the right spot on your little board. The first player to fill up all 4 spots on his board wins the game. It's that easy. Now, the rules also say that if you draw a piece that you don't need, then you can take that and give it to one of the other players that need it. Let's say you've already got a bed and you pull out another bed. Well, you can hand that over to somebody else who needs a bed. We're not really playing that way because it makes the game go faster, and really the game only lasts 5 to 10 minutes at the most, regardless. All of the pieces have specific shapes, of course, and when you stick your hand in the bag, you can recognize the pieces by how they feel. And that's what helps teach your kids about feeling and recognizing different shapes. Some of the monster pieces are similarly shaped, but it's really only difficult for a 3-year-old to figure out, not for an adult. My daughter has a lot of fun with this game. Mostly she enjoys pulling out the monster and yelling, "Go away, monster!" That's really where she gets the most enjoyment out of the game. Plus there's a little window in the box, and you can have the monsters in the window, and there's great fun to be had by all. Now, the game is really inexpensive, and if you're looking for a good first game for your kids, I suggest Go Away Monster. This week's podcast pondering is, what game are we looking forward to most getting for this holiday season? James, the gamer on the plains, chimes in first.
This is James Engelhart. Elliot and Jeff had talked a little bit about putting together some holiday wish lists, and so here's mine. Now, my wish list is going to be about new games that have caught my eye, especially ones that came out at Essen recently. Right at the top of my list, De Vulgare Eloquentia, coming out from Z-Man Games. The theme is just, I think, fantastic. That's something that really got my attention. It's about the transition from the sort of courtly Latin to the Vulgare language that Francesco de Assisi and Dante Alighieri wrote in. And, I mean, I'm sort of a interested in languages kind of guy, so that really, I'm just pretty jazzed about that. I'm also interested in the new Frager Games game, Antics. Now, there had been some early buzz about it, about that game as having some really amazing new mechanics. And, you know, now that we've had a chance to look at some of the gameplay and to look at the rules, it doesn't seem like it has a completely groundbreaking mechanism. But I do like the way that the action cards build, you know, the actions that you have available build at the same time that your ant colony physically builds. It's a kind of cool idea. I'm also interested in the Mousquetaire du Roi coming out from Rio Grande. Another fun theme. I really like the Dumas novel, so that should be a fun one. And I like the sort of slightly asymmetrical gameplay. Not slightly. It's asymmetrical gameplay. That seems like fun. And Elliot, of course, had talked about Mansions of Madness, and I'm keen to see that one. I would love to get that as a gift during the winter holidays, or perhaps, you know, pick it up myself during the winter holidays if it's out by then. It's a fantasy flight, of course. The bits look great. The story potential, the sort of ways you tell stories looks great. The glow-in-the-dark big bads, that sounds like fun. A little bit older, but just like a year or two, is Rio Grande's game Tobago, I think. The sort of deduction game. Not really deduction, it sounds like, as much as it's kind of driven by logic and logical choices as you're putting the island, or you're exploring the island of Tobago. So it's not like Mystery Express or Clue. God help us with Clue, right? There's a new Fantasy Flight version of The Hobbit. It's a Reiner Knizia. Looks like a great game. Looks like fun anyway. I don't know. I'd be interested to see how it plays. I always loved that book, and it seems like it's Knizia completing his Tolkien oeuvre. Maybe he's going to do a version of the Silmarillion, but God, I hope not. There's some smaller games, too, that maybe would be fun. Z-Man also has Onirim coming out, also a cooperative game. This is a card game about surviving and getting out of dreams. It looks like fun. Valley Games has Crows, which is a game about crows, which I just should point out here are deathly afraid of owls. If you want to freak out a crow, show them a picture of an owl. But anyway, I think the gameplay looks interesting. You've got tiles that you put down, and you've got some gems to put out and trash and different ways to attract the crows and score. It looks like a quick, fun game. Also fun is Spiral Galaxy Games' Braggart. The cards look hilarious, and it seems like a fun storytelling game in the I, Dark Overlord, or the adventures of Baron Munchausen, not Dr. Munchausen, Dr. Munchausen, Baron Munchausen, Baron Munchausen, Dr. Munchausen. But the adventures of Baron Munchausen tradition, and it seems like a fun kind of, you know, making stuff up on the fly with a bunch of friends. Seems like a drinking game to me, but yeah, that's just the kind of game day we have here at the Owl House. If I'm giving gifts to other people, though, if I'm making a list for others, I'm looking at Orchard by Haba. Beautiful game for my daughter. In this game, you roll a die, you remove a fruit, sometimes two fruit from the game that you put in your own little basket. If the die comes up with the raven face, then you have to start putting a puzzle together. And if the raven comes together before you get all the fruit off the table, well, then the raven wins, I guess, by swooping in and stealing all of your fruit. It's a bit like Hi-Ho Cheerio, but with a bit more cooperation. And although it seems like the new Hi-Ho Cheerio has a raven in the middle that you put together as a puzzle. Yeah. So anyway, Z-Man also has a fun looking little card game called Parade, which is themed around Alice in Wonderland, one of my wife's favorite stories. So that might be a gift idea here. My brother and his family, when we visited last year for these same winter holidays, I brought a copy of Gift Trap, and his family really liked that. So that's a thought. And Whitson Wager's family might be a good choice for them too. And I know that Elliot's had some good reviews and talking about that. So I'm really interested in that game. Now, if we flip the idea around, I just wanted to note that giving games as gifts can be a little tricky. Not everyone likes rules as much as we do. I mean, I can read rule sets all day and just be happy as a clam. I'd rather, you know, do that than work, really. But that's not normal. And other people, yeah, I don't know. You go too deep into the simulation and you might lose the person you wanted to impress, you know, or just the person you wanted to make happy. Like, hey, here's this great mechanic for choosing which deer you want to shoot. You know, you take that to your brother-in-law and, yeah, might not make a lot of sense to anybody, you know, who's outside the hobby. But party games can be good. I'd suggest a game that you think you'd like to play. You know, Gift Trap, for example, is a good sort of party game that could be fun. It is fun. But, you know, if Pictionary drives you nuts, don't give anybody Pictionary, right? And there are a lot of good games out there, of course. And, I mean, you know that, or you wouldn't be listening to the podcast. But still, it's hard to know if someone's going to take the time to even figure out how to play Ticket to Ride, which to you, to me, Elliot, Jeff, I'm thinking we're all going to say, are you kidding me? That's a simple, simple game. But yeah. Lastly, there's the hazards of giving someone your wish list, because they might just take it, take one look at it, say in their head, oh, look, board games, and head to Target or one of those other big stores. And so you end up with Monopoly Narnia. Then you get the gift, you open it up, you're like, oh, great. And the family's all around, and someone's going to say, hey, let's play this game. And they're going to look at you, and you can't say no, because you're the gamer, right? But then everyone starts to argue about who gets to be Mr. Tumnus. I want to be Mr. Tumnus. Oh, I want to be Mr. Tumnus. I want to be Mr. Tumnus. And it keeps getting louder. I want to be Mr. Tumnus. Until drunk Uncle Nick comes in from the other room. He's been watching some ball game, and he says, if you don't shut up about Mr. Tumnus, I'm going to... And then there follows this whole string of short nouns and verbs from the ancient Anglo-Saxon, and you're all just sitting there looking at each other, and when drunk Uncle Nick leaves, everybody thinks about Mr. Tumnus in new and very un-C.S. Lewis-like ways, and that's just no way to spend a holiday. If your relatives, you know, take one look at your list and go to Barnes & Noble, it might not be too bad. They really expanded their game selection. Still, you don't want to end up with a copy of Jishako, Jenga, and Santa Claus, the game. So be careful when you're giving these wish lists, who you're giving them to, right? So thanks for listening. I'm James Englehart, the gamer on the plains, and may all your tiebreakers break your way.
So Elliot, let me ask, what are you hoping that Santa Claus brings you in your stocking this year?
I have to say, I'm really looking forward to hopefully getting Civilization, the board game. It's the new release by Fantasy Flight, Sid Meier, and I've really enjoyed playing, you know, the Civilization video games. You know, I think Civ 5 just came out, actually.
Yeah, Civ 5's been out, about 6 months. Great game. Have you?
No, I haven't got a chance to play it yet. I'm hoping to get that for Christmas,
it's awesome.
Too.
It's awesome. Well, the new Civ game from Fantasy Flight is based on Sid Meier's design for the computer game. Civ 5.
Exactly. And I hear it's pretty good. I'm looking forward to actually getting a chance to play it. I love the Civ type games. I've played every Civilization PC game, up to 4 anyway. And you know, it's funny, we were talking about it before. One of the things I missed most about the earlier Civ games as opposed to the later ones is they used to do those little video segments.
Mm-hmm. Right. We were talking about that. When you would finish building one of the great wonders, they would play like a little video piece, even if it was something that doesn't exist anymore. They still did like a computer animated video piece.
Yeah, and I thought that was really neat.
It was very cool. You really had that sense of accomplishment. Uh-huh. I have to be very honest though, and I don't want you to be disappointed, the board game won't have that either.
Oh, damn. Well, that's what I'm looking forward to most for this coming holiday season. We'll see. I don't know.
Now, I should point out that Louis, who is a great supporter of the podcast and the website, and also happens to be a member of my biweekly gaming group, last time I saw him, he had just picked that up. Oh. He had just picked up Civilization, the board game, and I asked him what he thought. He said it was great. So I have not had an opportunity to play it myself either, but I could definitely see that being on a wish list. Oh, yeah. Myself, I'm kind of up in the air between two games. One, I'm sure, is going to be on a lot of people's wish lists, is Seven Wonders. Mm-hmm. I have heard great things about the game.
Yeah, me too.
Sounds like it was one of the big hits at this year's Essen. I'm hoping that this year I don't get coal in my stocking like usual. So maybe I can score that. The other game, and I kind of talked about this earlier on the website, kind of did a little sneak peek of The King's Musketeers, which is supposed to be coming out, if memory serves me correctly, from Rio Grande. It's a co-op game. It's a little similar, I guess, to Shadows over Camelot, because you'll have 4 or 5 of the players are actually playing musketeers, and then one person is actually playing the Lady de Winter, who's actually plotting against the musketeers. Haven't heard a lot about it since before Essen. I'm still keeping my eyes open for it. I'm hoping that there's a slim chance that I find that as well. I did want to mention that I did receive a Secret Santa gift from Jerry, and typical Jerry, what I received was solitaire tic-tac-toe. He did pull out all the stops. This time he actually did present me with some very nice pre-printed, well, I guess I would say, pre-drawn components. Unfortunately, they were on the back of some of his work stationery, so I don't think he spent a lot of money on it. But I guess it's the thought that counts.
Pre-production copy.
There you go. That's right. It was a master before it goes off to the printer.
Solitaire tic-tac-toe featuring just O's.
That's right. I like playing a solitaire game that I know I can win. So there you have it. There's what's on our wish list for this holiday season. I know there was one last item that you wanted to discuss, and it's going to be this week's Thoughts on Gaming.
And now it's time for Thoughts on Gaming with your hosts, Jeff and Elliot.
So this week, I ran across a post on BoardGameGeek where the question was, are written reviews becoming obsolete? You know, with the advent of the video review and podcast reviews, is video killing the written review star? Is basically what it boils down to.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, video killed the written review star. Video. Yeah, okay.
When I looked, it was 2 pages. Now it's going up to 5. There's a lot of discussion back and forth. Some people like video reviews. Some people like written reviews. You know, I don't know. In my opinion, that's probably how it's going to be.
Is the question, which is better, video reviews or written reviews? Or is the question, are written reviews going to be obsolete?
Exactly. No, that is the question. Is written reviews going to become obsolete? Is there going to be no use for a written review because we have all these video reviews now?
What are your thoughts?
Well, to tell you the truth, I get my information both ways. I mean, if I'm going to be looking up for what somebody thinks about a certain game, not somebody, but what reviews there are about a certain game, I'm most likely going to check the written reviews first. Because I can skim through those and it's all written out and I can get to it easier, enabling me to make a decision whether, you know, okay, should I try it? Should I not try it? Whereas now if I'm looking more for a little entertainment in addition to a review of the game.
Are you saying that our reviews, our written reviews are not entertaining?
They are entertaining to a certain portion of the populace, but, you know, there is definitely a need for the video reviews. And there are some people who are better at doing them than others. I mean, if you have somebody if there's somebody with a professional setup who has got a lot of experience doing it, making a lot of effort. I mean, I love Tom Vassell's video reviews. I love the ones that Scott Nicholson does. They're entertainment.
Well, Scott doesn't really review things anymore, though, does he? Aren't his videos more talking about design mechanics and things like that?
The latest one that he did was comparison of, okay, if people are only used to playing Monopoly, here are some designer board games that would help them satisfy certain cravings for whatever mechanics. Like if they like the auction mechanic, well, instead of playing Monopoly, try this game. And it was really a very interesting review and gave a lot of good information. But you're right, it wasn't really a review per se. But he does do reviews still as well.
Of course, yeah. But I mean, I just meant his videos. I'll give you another great example. Now, I'm not sure if they've done a video in a while because I don't think I've run across it. But Bored to Death TV, they do very good videos, very good quality. That's, I would say, probably the reason why you and I don't do video reviews is not that we're afraid of being on camera or anything like that. I just don't think we could probably pull it off as well as many of these other video reviewers do already.
I agree.
If we're not going to do something well, why bother doing it?
Yeah, exactly.
This podcast is certainly not an example of that, but still.
We're headed in that direction, though. 60, 70 episodes under our belt will be like pros, man.
That's right. We'll sound like we're on NPR.
I still believe, me personally, that there is definitely a need for written reviews because not everybody is going to take the time to sit and watch a 10-minute review, maybe to get an idea of what the components look like or see how the game is played a little bit. I'm not going to watch 10 minutes on a game when I can pull up a review, skim through it real quick, say, okay, I want this game.
I'm right with you. There's a few things that I look at as well. Are written reviews obsolete? I don't know. Do people still read? I mean, number one, I mean, honest, it's getting to the point where it's like, come on, everything can't just be instant gratification. the time it takes you to read a review is probably, you could probably read a review much faster than you can watch most of the video reviews out there. And I'm not talking about like Tom Vassell and the Dice Tower. And I know Eric Sommer, I saw one video that he did. I have to be honest, I don't know if he's done more. His was like a 3 minute. I think that was the whole selling point with his, was it was like a 3 minute review. But you'll see some, if you go to YouTube, you'll see people who have put multiple part reviews about a game and it's 30 minutes long. Right. I can understand where you want to see the components. You know, everything's subjective. Everything is an opinion. A review is an opinion. Yeah. We may say, hey, we love this game and other people don't. And we may say, well, you know, really don't like that game and other people like it. I mean, that's how it works. Video reviews have their place.
Yeah.
The way I look at it, when you go to a website that has written reviews, I take those reviews with a bit more authority than I do video reviews. Reason being, everybody can shoot video. Not everybody can do it well, like the people we've already mentioned. Anybody can shoot a video. Anybody can post a video on YouTube or Board Game Geek or wherever. When I read a review, and I'm not talking about going to a, you know, somebody's blog where they talk about everything and anything, and by the way, I like this game. I'm talking about when you go to a website that's devoted to the hobby and you read a review, I take a lot more from that review than I would from a video review.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is because these are people who are invested in the hobby. They take the hobby, you know, serious enough that they have a website. Those written reviews carry a lot more weight than a video review does.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you there. I really enjoy reading a lot of written reviews. And some of them can be to the point. Some of them, all of them have their own little opinions thrown in. And I can get to them quickly if I want to and skim through them or read them in detail. Whereas if I'm in a video review, I'm not going to like skip to catch a certain position of their mouth so I can see that they're going to now talk about this particular thing about the game. You know, whereas in a written review, I can skip through and say, okay. Oh, components. Here we go.
Here's something to keep in mind, too. Written reviews are much easier to find. So if you go to Google, put in, you know, a search term for whatever the game is, review, you're going to find the written reviews much easier than you will videos. When you go to YouTube and you put something in, you might get a few results that are what you're looking for. And then you get tons of stuff that has nothing to do with what you're looking for at all.
Yes, that's a good point.
I'm not like making excuses for us because we don't have video reviews. Yeah. Because I like video reviews myself. But the question isn't what's better, video or written. The question is, Poster is asking, why does anybody bother with written reviews anymore? Something along those lines to me is like, why don't you just ask, why do people even bother writing books anymore? Really?
Let's go straight to movie for everything.
So there you have it. That's my take. I think that absolutely not. I don't think they'll become obsolete. I think we're lucky. We're in a point in time where we have a lot of great resources out there to be able to give people knowledge to base their purchases on.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Written reviews are not becoming obsolete. Cool.
No, not at all. So I believe there you have it.
Yeah, there you have it. That's cool. Hey, we did it. Okay. Well, looks like that's it for this time.
I believe you, sir, are correct. Everyone out there, keep in mind, we are going to be back well before the holidays hit. And on our next podcast, Elliot and I, and hopefully James, will chime in with our favorite games of 2010.
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. Our show notes are provided by James Englehart and can be found on our website. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.